Hey friends, it's your host Shane Blackshear. For the past month, it has been my pleasure to introduce you to the Arizona indie rock band Wild Earth and their brand new full-length album, Holy Fools. This sophomore album aims to unite pop, experimental, alt-rock sounds with spiritual formation in Christ. Listen to the wild, vulnerable, and contemplative journey of Holy Fools right now online on your favorite digital streaming like iTunes, Apple Music, Spotify, or visit wildearthmusic.com. For fans of Gunger, Mute Math, Foster the People, Loud Harp, United Pursuit, and Seminary Dropout, check out Wild Earth. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Dr. Russell Jung. Russell is a leading sociologist of Asian Americans, race, and religion. He's a professor of Asian American Studies at San Francisco State University. The author of books on race and religion, he lives in Oakland, California with his wife Joan and three children. They attend New Hope Covenant Church. Russell, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks, Shane.
So the new book is called A Home in Exile, Finding Jesus Among My Ancestors and Refugee Neighbors. I know from the book, your father worked really hard to make it into the middle class. And so it sounds like you grew up in a middle class household. And yet it seems like when you came of age, it wasn't too hard for you to not try to cling to those advantages and those creature comforts of the middle class.
Yep. No, So what happened to me is I grew up in a Chinese American household, and my father and my mother both grew up during the Depression, and so they both had a real high value of upward mobility and trying to escape poverty by any means, and then keeping their kids sort of, you know, happily ensconced in the middle class. And even within our church communities, people said, well, if you do well, then it's God's blessing if you're able to get educated, go to good schools. And being Asian American, that gets reinforced all around you. But what happened to me is I went on a trip to China, and back then China was really, it hadn't gone through liberalization. And so everybody wore the same clothes. Everybody lived at the same standard. And I lived pretty much in the same level as my fellow Chinese teachers. And there I just found that I didn't really need all the stuff that we had in America, that the depth of relationships, the lifestyle of just being was made me content enough. And so I have a really good example of that type of contentment, if you want to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so I'm living in China, and this, again, is before they went to a market economy. And so back then there were no mirrors around. There wasn't any advertising. And so I would wake up and I would just run my fingers through my hair and go to class. And I had no idea how I looked. But when I looked at my students, they all looked pretty bad themselves, that they all had chronic bouts of bedhead and they were all dressed the same. Mm-hmm. And so they were ugly, I was ugly, but we were all sort of content because we all looked similarly ugly. And so I was sort of happy, not caring about how I looked, until I went to Hong Kong for a little vacation. And in Hong Kong, it's sort of like the capital of capitalism, and there's ads everywhere, and there's, you know, billboards and mirrors where you look at yourself and you compare yourself to all the advertisements around you. And in Hong Kong, all the models sort of looked like me because they were all Asian, whereas in the U.S., the models back then tended to be white, so I didn't really think of myself in comparison to the models. But in Hong Kong, everybody looked like me, including the models, but the models looked way better than I did. And that just created this great sense of dissatisfaction for me, where I realized, gee, I got to get a haircut. I got to do something with my teeth. And so just living in those two environments, you know, one right after the other, where I come out of a sort of contented, who cares how you look environment to a media saturated, you need to buy, you need to consume in order to satisfy your desires, really showed me, wow, our desires and our wants, our contentment and our expectations are really shaped by our media and our environment. And I realized I don't want to live so saturated, so influenced by the world. And I just tried to live as simply as possible after that.
So after you come back from the U.S., you wind up, it sounds like through a contact at your church, moving to a neighborhood in Oakland called Murder Dubs, where you've been for over 20 years now. How did you first land there?
Well, I was a grad student at Berkeley at the time, getting my PhD in sociology. And so for one class on participant observation, I wanted to study how Christian faith-based organizations may differ from other nonprofits. And so I visited a place called Harbor House in East Oakland. It was a neighborhood center that had youth programming, ESL for refugees, food pantries, those kinds of things. And I found that the youth were a lot more interesting than the Christian staffers, because the youth were all very multiracial, but they were sort of dominated by Asian gangs who adopted urban underclass ways. And so I began to work with them a lot more closely. And so I spent 3 months in Oakland, moving into the Murder Dubs just to follow the gang kids and to study them. And what happened over those 3 months, I moved into an apartment that was made up mostly of Cambodian refugees and undocumented Latinos. In those 3 months at this place called Oak Park Apartments, I think I found, you know, that treasure in the field that you're willing to sell everything for, or that pearl of great price. I just found God in amazingly new ways among the poor. And I just never left, because for me, it's sort of the kingdom of God on earth that I wanted to explore, enjoy, and inhabit.
Well, living in solidarity with the poor is a huge theme throughout the book. And I think for people who have been a part of the Christian church in America, they're familiar with the idea of maybe taking a mission trip to, you know, in Texas, it's here to Mexico, or even overseas somewhere, or even just another part of the country in the U.S., and maybe doing some kind of service project for the poor. But that's just so very different from actually living with the poor and living in solidarity with the poor. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how that process changed you.
Yeah. Well, on all of these short-term mission trips, people come back saying, well, the people taught me a lot more than I could ever teach them.
Right.
Or they would say, wow, the poor are so happy and joyous. And the assumption still is that, oh, we in the middle class, we American Christians, we white evangelicals have much more to offer than the people we're going to visit. Oh, we in the middle class actually should be happier because we're in the middle class, and the poor shouldn't be so joyous because they're so poor. But for me, I think the truth is that Jesus said, blessed are the poor, for a really good reason, for multiple reasons. And for me as a middle-class person, finding solidarity with the poor helps me to understand why the poor are blessed, how much they know God in different ways, how much they're connected to Jesus in a very lived experience, how much they really do have to teach the American church about full discipleship. So for example, in our church, we have someone who was a lifer in prison but got out just recently. And so we had dinner with him, and he was just sharing how much, just a totally different perspective of following Jesus, of what freedom means, of what the world has to offer in comparison to what Jesus has to offer. And so living among homeless people, living among refugees, living among lifers, for me, gives me a taste of, again, the kingdom of heaven that I don't think I would get in the middle class. And there are so many stories of how my neighbors who are poor, my refugees who have been exiled, have shared with me what we Christians should be doing in terms of relating to each other, relating to our environment, relating to God. So, yeah, a lot of people go on these short-term missions, but they go back home and they resume their normal lives. I went on a short-term mission and thought, wow, this is the way of life. This is the life of discipline, the life of discipleship.
And it seems like the sense of community was really palpable there too.
Right. Because in our neighborhood, you really needed each other. It's really interesting. Just this past Sunday, our youth Sunday school class, we made some cheeseburgers for this class exercise on being the body of Christ and serving one another. And we had a whole bunch of leftover sandwiches and hamburgers. And so we just opened our door and went outside, and we started offering the hamburgers and sandwiches to people. And people just took them so readily. And I was really struck how strangers would just willingly receive the food we were offering without knowing who we were, what kind of food it was, how sanitary and hygienic it was. And they were just open to receiving and accepting gifts from others. And I think in some ways, living in the inner city, you develop a great mistrust for others and distrust because you have to watch your back. But at the same time, you realize, well, I'm needy. I could readily receive the gifts from others. I don't know sufficient. So there's one story for me when I first moved in Oak Park. Everybody welcomed me so well, both the kids and the grandmas. They would feed me. They would take care of me. And there was one time when, as a grad student, I was working there, and there were a lot of drug dealers around, and we began to organize to get rid of the drug dealers. And the drug dealers then knew it was us who was organizing against them because we were the most likely people to call the police, who could speak English, who would actually complain. And so the drug dealers began to threaten us. They were threatening my roommate and I. They would slash our tires, and then their drug runners would actually break into our home and steal my computer. And so this happened one time, and I really needed my computer because I was a grad student and all my notes were on it. And then word on the street was that I could buy my computer back. And for me, that was like, well, that's sort of cool. I never get words on the street, and, you know, especially if you're a middle-class suburban type person, you don't go out on the street. But I got a word on the street that I could get my computer back. And so then I actually called the police and said, hey, word on the street is I can get my computer back. And they said, great, we'll wire you, and then we'll arrest the guy and the guys who stole your computer. And I go, well, that's sort of fun to be in a like CSI TV movie environment. So I went back, and word on the street was that I could go talk to the guy named Roach, who lived kitty quarter from me, and Roach could get me my computer. And Roach was living with George, this convicted manslaughterer. He's like 300 pounds. So there's George and Roach, and I would go up to Roach and said, hey, word on the street, I could get my computer back. He goes, okay, I'll see what I can do. So we make the deal, and he says, okay, bring me this amount of money, and I'll get you your computer back. So I go back to the police, and I said, oh, the ego has landed. I've made the deal. Wire me up. And then the police said, "Yep, sorry, our technician is gone for the weekend, and we can't help you." And so I'm thinking, geez, why? No wonder nobody ever calls the police. They're not very useful. They're not very protective. And the police said, just go buy your computer back if you're so desperate for it. I said, fine, I don't need the police. I just want to get my computer back. And so the deal has been set. The Eagles landed. I have all this money. I'm going to go meet Roach in the middle of the night. And then I realize, wait a minute, that's sort of stupid to come out with all this cash in the middle of the night to meet a guy named Roach who could just rob me, right? And so I tell my neighbors who are Cambodians if they could watch me, because the deal was supposed to be done in the parking lot and they lived in the second floor apartment and they could watch me in the parking lot. And they also had guns. I knew this because everybody had guns. But my Cambodian neighbors didn't really understand me and something got lost in the translation. So when I went out to go meet Roach, they came out with me and they came out, two or three of them flanked behind me. And if you know how, like, you remember that Michael Jackson Beat It music video?
Yeah.
You know, where he's sort of like waving his arms and snapping his fingers or even like West Side Story. That's what we were like. I went out in front and in slow motion with music, you know. I got these Cambodian guys packing guns, walking behind me, and then we're going to meet Roach. So we go out, and Roach has got this gangster leaning back on top, you know, against his car with his arms folded. And I go, "What's up?" And he goes, "What up?" And I go, "Okay, I've got the money. Eagles landed." And he said, "Oh, sorry, your computer has been fenced." And that was the end of my CSI TV. Nothing happened. I didn't get to buy my computer. It's sort of a flat ending. But what I realized later afterwards is that in the midst of me losing my computer and being really frustrated about having drug dealers as my enemies all around me, that I also had the entire community supporting me. I had my manager and word on the street helping me. I had Roach willing to buy back my computer for me. I had Kosal and my Cambodian neighbors walking out with me, having my back with guns. And another time, my car got broken into and I was cleaning up all the glass and Kosal, my Cambodian neighbor, came out to help me. This is around midnight. And I was thanking him profusely and he said, "That's okay, Russell. We're all in this together." Hmm. And for me, it was just a poignant statement that in my community of poor underclass people in the murder dubs, we realize we're all in this together, that we're all needy, that we all have to rely on each other, and we all have to trust God for our safety, for our livelihood, for our health. And that kind of solidarity of the poor, that kind of having people watch my back, giving me words on the street, are like a Holy Spirit word of knowledge, you know, that you're cared for, you're embraced, you're loved. And so that's, for me, just one example of the solidarity that I've received that I feel like is very much like how the Christian community ought to be.
I loved reading that story in the book about your computer and how, you know, you lost something of that legitimately was of value. You had all your research on there as a student. And it cost you something, but you did gain really this kind of beautiful community, you know, that was willing to kind of be in solidarity with you too, and you know, do what you need to do to get your computer back.
Yeah, it's very interdependent. You know, the United States is so individualistic. Even in church small groups, where you think you have this great tight community, it's still very much based on this sort of market exchange model of, oh, if I go and share, people are going to give back to me. But I think this true Christian, or more true Christian community, is one where we're based a lot more like Alcoholics Anonymous, where we all recognize, well, we're all sinners. We really need help. We're all desperate. And only by being together and supporting one another can we actually, you know, live day to day.
So you, through the course of living there, you and your neighbors kind of banded together to sue your landlord, who hadn't really been treating tenants right. And I know that that was kind of a roller coaster of emotions from beginning to end.
So we were living in a place called Oak Park Apartments, and we had been living there for 5 years and have been getting to know our neighbors, organizing them around certain issues like racial profiling, welfare reform, various issues. We had a community organizing model of ministry where we would just sort of rally around the issues that affected our tenants. And after 5 or 6 years, during one El Nino year, our apartment, the physical conditions had really deteriorated. And so during an El Nino rain winter, almost everybody's apartment flooded. You know, their ceilings would leak, their sewers would back up. And because of those conditions, the mold got a lot worse. And that winter, 6 or 7 households of families would have to bring their kids to the emergency room for asthma attacks. Mm. And so they were separate households. And so this is sort of a case of environmental racism, where it wasn't individuals who were prone to getting sick. It was the environment that was causing them to get sick. And it was racism because the landlord knew that the conditions were bad, but he also knew that the tenants were immigrants who wouldn't complain. They were Cambodians who went through the killing fields and were afraid of dealing with the government. They were undocumented people who didn't want to get deported. And so we felt like our landlord wasn't just deferring maintenance, but sort of willfully suspending maintenance, mm-hmm. and allowing people to live in squalid conditions. And he was still getting consistent rent. So we thought, well, what can we do to help our neighbors? And then again, I was living here with my roommate, and we were going through the same conditions. You know, my apartment had mice, roaches, fleas, you know, spiders. We had fires, electrical fires. We had sewer backups. And so we consulted an attorney, and the attorney said, yeah, why don't you guys file a lawsuit? And usually the threat of a lawsuit would get your landlord to bring the building up to code. So we asked him about that, and he said, but you'd have a stronger case if you get more tenants involved. And we said, okay, we'll do that. And because we had such a community organizing model, we would go door to door and we would invite people over for coffee. And we actually organized our neighbors, and there were 56 units or 52 units in this apartment complex. So we got actually over 200 of our neighbors to sign on this lawsuit and say, yeah, we are living in squalid conditions. Yeah, we're having health problems. Yeah, we're getting robbed because the building isn't secure. And so we felt like that's one of God's miracles, is that we got a lot of people to actually stand up for their rights. So rarely do you see Cambodians standing up for their rights. Rarely do you see Latinos stand up for their rights. Rarely do you actually see them working together across languages to stand up for their rights. And then never do you see evangelicals coming to stand alongside and live among them to stand up for the rights. And that's what we had. I think this Oakland Tribune newspaper had a headline, an unlikely tenants coalition sues landlord. And that's what we were. We were really unlikely, but that was God's work among this unlikely coalition to sue. But what happened over time is, so we sue, and then so the city gets involved, and they actually send inspectors, and we have like dozens of code violations. So our building actually gets condemned because it was so, there was so much squalor. And so we're hoping that the city's penalties to the landlord and our lawsuit would force our landlord to make the changes, but instead they file for corporate bankruptcy and said, ha-ha, you can't touch us. We're not personally liable. We have no money to fix up the building. You guys just all have to leave. And so we Christian organizers thought, crap, what have we done? We've sort of organized our community. We told them their rights, but now were actually splitting up the community because now the building's condemned. And so at that point, we Christians, we began to pray daily in the morning, asking God to help us, confessing how angry and bitter we were at our landlord. And now this is like two years in, we're living in a condemned building, and then finally God breaks through. We were desperate. We were looking around for places to move, but then God breaks through during bankruptcy court. And the city had an attorney named Johnny Angel, who actually helped organize both the city and the landlords and the bank. And together we went to bankruptcy court and said, we're going to work together to take away the property from our landlord. And so really rarely, again, this is another unlikely coalition, rarely do creditors fight or work together to get the money owed to them. Usually they fight for their piece of the pie.
Sure.
But we got these creditors to work together in a legal battle against our landlord. And at that point, our landlord agreed, and we win this big settlement. We win $1 million in damages. But more importantly, we force our landlord to sell the building to a nonprofit. And then the city gave us funding, and so what used to be one-bedroom apartments that were roach-infested, leaking roofs, mold-filled, asthma-inducing, you know, slums, all became 3 to 4 bedrooms, up to date with solar panels, ambient heating, very clean. And so we won this great housing victory, a great community organizing victory. And we would go around saying, look at God's given us justice, and we were really happy. And so that's our Oak Park story of us coming together and God intervening, both to organize us and to give us a victory for better health. So that's great. And I used to go around, you know, sharing this story, how good God is, how we could transform our communities. You know how all these Christian organizations said, you know, God sent us Christians to go and, you know, totally transform our neighborhoods. But what happened years later was sort of the unintended consequences and this ironic twist that even though we won better housing and bigger housing, we lost our sense of community. Because what happened is now that people had bigger houses like the American Dream, the families began to retreat and kids wouldn't play with each other as much because they would have their own bedrooms where they could study or play video games. You know, parents wouldn't go out to interact because they had their own apartments where they could cook and watch TV. So what had been this vibrant sort of ethnic village became this sort of dead suburban complex. And it's really bittersweet for me as one of the organizers, because I got kicked out because I didn't make the housing income requirements. And so we sort of lost our sense of community even though we won a lawsuit. And I've had to reflect a lot since then about what's it mean to fight for God's justice and shalom in the city. Do we ever have these sort of happily ever ending stories, you know? So that's when you live, you can go in and do like a mission trip and work even 3 to 5 years and try to claim victory. But if you live in a place for decades, some things change, but then some things don't change at all. And so I still live in this low income neighborhood that's still has a lot of crime and poverty and struggle.
If you could go back, do you know how you would do it differently?
No, I think one of the lessons I've learned is that, yeah, in retrospect, I don't know what I would have done differently in terms of organizing or in terms of what were our aims or how we would go about it. I think it's sort of like life. We just have to take steps of faith one step at a time, and you really can't see what the future is going to foretell. So that's why a lot of times in the Bible, God's always asking people to go. You know, his primary instruction is go, get up and go. And you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to eventually arrive at your destination. Moses didn't. All those people in Hebrews 11, a lot of them didn't meet their ultimate destination. And so I think that's the story of Christian pilgrimage, that we're supposed to go, we're supposed to lead lives of faith, but we're not necessarily promised happily ever ending stories that a lot of politicians or other Christian leaders would have you believe.
Through your experiences there in that community, you really came to embrace your ethnic heritage, which, and I'll apologize in advance, is the people group called Hakka?
Yeah, Hakka.
Can you tell us a little bit of history about that people group and then why that that became meaningful to you to embrace that heritage?
Yeah. So, so I'm living among these refugees, and it wasn't just Cambodian. There were people from Laos and Southeast Asia, and later on, people, refugees from Bosnia moved into our neighborhood. And so I'm reflecting a lot on refugee resettlement and how to work best with refugees. And then, you know, in the United States, I'm a sort of, well, personally, I'm a sort of narcissistic, and I always wanted to be special in some way. I always wanted to stand out. And I think if you ever watch any Disney movie, it's the same theme where you have this sort of misfit individual like Moana or Mulan or Elsa in Frozen, these misfit characters who need to find themselves because they don't really fit in their community. And that's how I felt. And so I one way that a lot of people find specialness in the United States now, especially with this discourse of multiculturalism, is to take pride in their ethnicity. And so I thought, okay, well, being Chinese American, that's pretty common. But being Chinese Hakka is sort of different and unique and cool. So I thought, well, I'll explore my Chinese Hakka identity so that I could be a little bit special, like someone in a Disney movie, you know, like a Hakka prince I might be. So I researched what it meant to be Hakka. My father always told me, oh, don't forget, you're Hakka. Hakka are like pirates and nomads and lovers. And so they're supposed to be this sort of swashbuckling kind of pirates of the Caribbean of China. And so I go back and I research the Hakka because I want to be special. I want to be like a Disney animated feature. I want to be a Pirates of the Caribbean ride. But then when I find out about the Hakka, they were just total, they were like the losers of China. They, the Hakka literally means guest people. They don't have a name of their own. They have the name of what other people call them. And because the Hakka had no land, they were called the guest people. And the Hakka were just considered to be the underclass poor of China who didn't have their own land. And so they were nomads and had to keep on moving throughout China because nobody really wanted them. And in my family's story, the Hakka moved from the middle of China, thousands of miles through great migrations to the southeast end of China. They lose a bunch of wars against locals and eventually, you know, get pushed to the ocean. They were actually put on a reservation right by the ocean because they got pushed out. And so my great-great-grandfather, realizing that he had no future in China, had no land in China, he migrated to California. And back then in the 1800s, most Chinese who migrated were mostly men who hoped to make a fortune in America and then go back to China. But my great-great-grandfather actually brought his entire family because he felt like, well, we Hakka have no future in China. And so he brought his entire family to California. And so my family has been in the United States for six generations now. And I've realized, like, my Hakka ancestry and story isn't this great rags-to-riches story, but really is a story of being like the refugees among myself, that we're just a people who are dispossessed, a bunch of people who are underclass, a bunch of people who are despised, people who always had to hope for the future because their present wasn't very satisfying. And so I learned about my Hakka heritage, and it isn't special. It wasn't unique. It wasn't something that I take pride in. But claiming to be Hakka actually put me in the same sort of position as my refugee neighbors. And as I learned from my refugee neighbors and as I read scriptures more, I realize more and more that the Jesus that we follow, the Jesus that we love, really was Hakka himself. That Jesus himself, at a young age, had to leave his country because of war and go to Egypt. Jesus had to be a migrant. Jesus had to grow up in Galilee, a land of violence, in a neighborhood like murder doves. Jesus himself was despised and underclass like Hakka. Jesus had no place to lay his head like a Hakka. And so then for me, the more I get in touch with my Hakka roots, as sort of disparaged as it is, the more I could develop solidarity with the poor, the more I understand who Jesus was and is. And the more I could understand Jesus, the more I understand the depth of compassion and love God has for us, because he went through all the suffering, because he understood all our situations of frailty, that Jesus also went on a journey to the cross. And so solidarity with the poor, reclaiming my Hakka heritage, just connects me with Jesus in ways that's, I think, is really different from white evangelical ways or American Christianity, but actually puts me in touch with Jesus and deepens my faith, I think, that I think I'd like to share with the broader church.
Well, I'm glad you said that. What do you think that the Asian Americans have to teach the American church?
Yeah, I'm a little bit frustrated and always been frustrated and felt marginalized by the broader white American church. You know, I grew up very fundamentalist, and so just supposed to take the Bible literally. But I was going to a Chinese fundamentalist church, and I thought that was sort of weird, because if we took the Bible literally, then there should be no ethnic congregations. It should be neither Jew nor Greek, male or female, slave or free. Right. We should be equal and reconciled and worshiping together. But I found the American church not to be that way, but it was clearly segregated, clearly not taking the Bible fully, but actually having very American cultural dispositions and orientations, especially in terms of a sort of individualistic orientation, that how you read the Bible, how you follow Jesus was really mostly about you and God and your personal salvation and, you know, there's a purpose-driven life for you, and you just got to find out how you're special and God has a particular vocation for you. And so a lot of American Christianity is very oriented towards the individual, and that's true. I believe God cares about the individual, but that American individualism pervades Christianity and actually heightens one's individualism. And for me, like I said, I'm pretty narcissistic. It actually heightens my own sort of self-obsession, self-focus. And I needed to get out of that self-focus in order to be able to love the way Jesus loved, in order to develop the compassion and justice that I think God talks about. And developing a more Asian American perspective helps counterbalance that American individualism that I grew up with and that sort of permeates American culture. So there are a couple of things that Asian American and Asian culture, and one is just, again, having a collective point of view versus an individualistic point of view, that you think of the group first rather than thinking about your own needs first. And if you read the Bible in those ways, you'll realize that most of the scriptures were written to groups of people, not to individuals. That God's primary aim is not only to save people individually, but to save a people for himself. And so I use 1 Peter 2 about being a God's special possession, his royal priesthood, his chosen nation, that sense of peoplehood, having a collective perspective. I write about that a lot, trying to develop an Asian American Christian perspective, theological vantage point that provides corrective to individualism. So in topics like vocation, topics about how to raise your family, topics about even finding your identity, I try to take a collective approach, saying your primary identity isn't just about you and your passions and your individual calling. Your identity is really as being the church. Your identity is really about being a called out, saved community. Your identity is really about being a reconciled people. And having that collective perspective really mitigates some of the excesses of individualism.
You now, like I said in your bio at the beginning, you've got a son, you've also have foster children, and I think it is the church, American church's number one idol is to, for people to have their kids or want their kids to live in a safe neighborhood. And I wonder if it was a new challenge to you going from living where you did as a single person and then a married person, and going from that to actually having children that you were responsible for, and if that changed the way you looked at where you lived and if that made the sacrifice greater for you.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of missionaries and a lot of Christian workers talk about this, like, I'm willing to sacrifice my own life, but I'm not willing to sacrifice my kid's life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But Abraham was called to sacrifice Isaac. And so if you're going to be really follow the Bible and try to like live lives of faith, what's it matter if we gain this world but lose our souls? And I think the same for my own kid. But raising a kid, yeah, his safety and my kid's education are really paramount for us and really creates a lot of faith crises for us. When I was single, you know, I could live dangerously on the edge, and I sort of liked it because I was single and free and sure. Wanted to be in a Disney Pirates of the Caribbean adventure. But with my own kids, and, you know, I don't want to risk their lives. I don't want to expose them to gunshots needlessly. I don't want them to have a substandard education so they're going to be wanting to join a gang and drop out. And so we've had to balance out those values for education, for safety, with our call to be Christian witness, to live simply, to live in solidarity with the poor. I think it's a continual struggle. And in terms of safety, you know, when my kid was a baby and he was with us, we've had bullets go through our windows when our kid was right around. We saw bullets embedded in our front wall. And so sadly, our kid is sort of like a prisoner in his own home. We put up gates because, you know, people would walk into our duplex and just take stuff. So we put up gates, and we don't let our kid out that often by himself. So he's actually sort of like under house arrest because he can't go out. He's 13 now. He can't go out unless he's accompanied by an adult. And that's why a lot of kids in the city are overweight, is because they're not free range kids. They're actually, again, house prisoners because we don't feel safe letting him out by himself. And that's actually like one of the sacrifices. We always long for, oh, I wish he could go out like other kids and explore and just be free. But that's not a reality for us in the city, it's not safe. And so, you know, kids get obese because they have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to play.
Sure.
If we sent our kids to the local school, the only kids left in the public school are those who are English learners or maybe special ed kids, because all the white middle class people in Oakland, even though they make up a third of the public school population in elementary school, they all leave by middle school. And so there's actually more Pacific Islanders going to public school than white people in Oakland, you know. And so we wrestle a lot with raising our families in an environment that's dangerous and has low educational opportunity, where its schools are more dropout factories than they are, you know, places of equal opportunity. Yet at the same time, I think we're raising our kids as much as possible with a way to grow up in the Christian faith. So my little tagline is, I want my kid to be compassionate, not competitive. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up being pretty academically competitive. I go to Stanford University, and there I really learned, if you want to succeed in this world, my major advisor said, just be the best. And she assumed we at Stanford could be the best, and therefore we'll get whatever we deserve. It's that competitiveness and entitlement that I got out of Stanford. So I got those values. I got that orientation. But I didn't learn any compassion at Stanford. So I got a world-class education, but no compassion. And so now when I hang out where I am and try to relate to people, I don't think I love as well as I could because I grew up with that value system. And I don't want my kids to grow up like me, you know, with a sense of entitlement, with a sense of privilege, with this inability to relate to 99% of the world. And so raising my kids now in Oakland, hopefully they are getting a greater sense of compassion. So my kid grows up, we hang out among homeless encampments. We have refugee families all over. We have daughters who are refugees. We foster other kids who were trafficked. And so as my kid grows up in this environment and he hears the story of people who are in prison all their lives, who had to escape trafficked situations, I think he's getting an understanding of God's heart, God's love for all races, and a God's sense of justice, how much we really need God's shalom in this earth, because it's really screwed up for most of the world.
I mean, I think it comes down to what we want most for our kids. If we want them to be wealthy, then, you know, being at the best school is going to be really important. But if we want them to love the Lord and to be in solidarity with the poor, then maybe these other things are more important.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, just take the Beatitudes. Do we raise our kids to put them in the best position to live out the Beatitudes?
Hmm.
If Jesus said, blessed are the poor, are you going to live among the poor? Are you going to raise your kids with the poor? Are you going to try to distance yourself from the poor? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Will your kid really hunger and thirst after righteousness, which isn't being right before God? It means really right relationships with everybody. But if you're living in a sort of gated suburban community, does he have really right relationships with the rest of the world? And so, yeah, if you're really Bible believing, if you're really wanting to follow Jesus and you really want to teach the values of Jesus, to me, as a parent, you want to put your kid in the best position to develop those values, to understand them, and have opportunities to live them out, not just for a one-week short-term mission trip, but to make it your lifestyle, to make it your character, to make it your being, to know Jesus of the Beatitudes, know Jesus who went to the cross.
Well, Russell, the book is wonderful, and there's so many stories in it, and it's also really funny. Disney movies played a more prominent role in it than I expected.
Yeah.
But it's so wonderful and something we need so badly. So thank you, and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Shane. Thanks for the opportunity to share.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,